This is an I Am Listening original podcast.
I certainly hope that the politics in this country is better for the fact that people like me, who don't have a political background, are, you know, in terms of my family or anything like that, is able to start thinking about how we solve things for ordinary people. And that hopefully over time will mean that we will get a better country. And that's ultimately the reason why I'm here.
Welcome to the Kent Politics Podcast, your go-to source for insightful discussions on local and national political matters. Join us as we take a deep dive into local government across the county. Find out what the key decision makers have to say, what your money is being spent on, and how the party's policies could affect how we live. Plus, don't miss our regular feature, Westminster Watch, where we dissect the latest developments and decisions shaping the political landscape in the heart of the UK's capital. Engage with us as we delve into the issues that matter to you and explore the dynamic world of politics from a Kent perspective.
Welcome to another edition of the Kent Politics Podcast. In the week farmers were revolting, literally, the county faces getting its biggest ever solar farm, and we're looking back at 10 years to one of the most thrilling parliamentary by-elections ever staged in Kent. My name is Simon Finlay, local democracy reporter covering Kent County Council. And with me is Robert Boddy, who's been looking after a Medway Council this week.
Hello.
And Dan Essen, who covers the borough and district councils.
Hello.
Plus, senior news editor Nikki White, who's been looking at the national and international picture for us.
Hello.
And later on, we'll be speaking to Polly Billington, the newly elected Labour MP for East Thanet. First up, Rob, what's been happening Medway?
Well, the story I'm going to talk about this week might be accused of being a bit old news, since I'm going to talk about the 10-year anniversary of the Rochester and Strood by-election, which took place in 2014, when Mark Reckless unexpectedly walked out onto the stage at UKIP party conference and announced he was defecting from the Conservative Party. It was an intense six-week campaign with a national and international media frenzy, so I got in contact with the three main candidates, Mark Reckless for UKIP, Kelly Tolhurst for the Tories, and Nashaba Khan for Labour, to talk about their experience.
I remember well, actually, because I covered it. I was working for the Maidstone and Medway News.co.uk website, nice daily departed, and it was a very, very interesting, very lively, shall we put it, campaign, and But the one thing I do remember about him most, actually, was the fact he couldn't get close to Tolhurst or Reckless. Kelly was being represented by a guy called Richard Holden, who was their campaign manager for that. And he eventually became the Tory party chairman. Now he's, I think, an Essex MP somewhere. And Reckless, you simply couldn't get close to them, partly because the stakes were so high that no one could afford to put a foot wrong.
Absolutely, yeah.
But what it did show us was kind of one of the stars for the future. And Nashaba Khan was the Labour Party candidate. And she was quite sort of young, quite, you know, inexperienced and all the rest of it. But she came across as a bit of one for the future. And as we've seen, she's just recently been elected as an MP.
Yes. So, I mean, a couple of things that we all remember. I mean, firstly, the surprise. And that was intentional. Neither Tolhurst nor Khan had any indication that it was coming. And Reckless said this was deliberate, because if there was any clue he was thinking about it, the party, the Conservative Party, would move against him. He said his key memory of the experience was that first moment of stepping out onto the stage in Doncaster and the overwhelming reaction.
Dozens and dozens of cameras and, well, at least 100 journalists as I sort of walked into that count. I mean, that's something that sort of stays with you and wasn't something I perhaps anticipated or thought in advance or understood how that would be. It was also through the period sort of of the by-election, and certainly when I went up to sort of London and to Parliament afterwards, I was in Parliament, I think, sort of 10 o'clock
the next morning
to debate the NHS, which I'd promised to do. And I was, you know, having both the Conservative and the Labour front bench, everyone sort of
going from into Dennis Skinner. It was
more demanding than it had been being as a sort of Conservative backbench.
Additionally, another key moment which people may remember was when Emily Thornberry, then Shadow Attorney General, tweeted an image of a white van with some England flags, which was widely perceived as snobbish. And Nashaba Khan says she's not sure how much of a difference they actually made in terms of the vote count, since it came out at 3 p.m. on polling day, but said it caused the Labour Party to reevaluate itself and its relationship with its traditional working class base, which they had been perceived as straying from.
It was one of those situations where one pivotal moment may have turned that election away from the Labour Party, who were, you know, typically quite well, or at least give a showing that showed that they were very much in contention for taking seats like this. particularly since the right of centre vote was going to split or could split. Yeah, it was very interesting because Emily Thornberry was sort of then sort of seen as a sort of, you know, she's a barrister by trade, you know, white middle class woman, sort of sticking her nose into, you know, what was by and large a fairly working class white area. Well, it's actually mixed, very mixed. Ethnically, but seen as a sort of a slightly deprived area, and that really wasn't the kind of look that they wanted so close to the actual sort of the close of the polling. So tell me, you know, you obviously sort of have been in touch with all the three candidates. What did they have to say for themselves for looking back on it?
Well, I mean, all three candidates said it was an experience like no other, and the level of scrutiny from the media was incredibly intense. I mean, Kelly Torhurst said when she was considering on whether or not to stand in the following election, which was in May 2015, she wasn't totally sure she wanted to do it because of some of the personal attacks she'd faced based upon the way she looks and the way she speaks during the by-election campaign. However, all three said they don't think of the experience as a negative one, and actually were all glad to have gone through it. They were divided on whether or not the eventual Brexit referendum would have happened without it, but Reckler said he regretted nothing, as he believes the by-election was necessary to push David Cameron to calling that referendum, and eventually he got the result he wanted and got Britain to leave the EU.
Dan, what have you been looking at then?
So I've been casting my eye over yet more potentially historic infrastructure projects, but this time it's one of the biggest solar farms, or the biggest solar farm ever proposed in Kent, one of the biggest proposed in the country, and it's down in the wilds of Romney Marsh.
Well, you say big, how big?
So South Kent Energy Park, as they're calling it, would cover almost 1,500 acres of land, something like 800 football pitches. And it would pretty much surround the village of Old Romney by the looks of the maps. In power terms, it's planned to generate 500 megawatts and include a storage facility for the same amount. That's enough to power 20% of the homes in Kent for a year, they say. And you know, bigger than most other solar farms as well. The biggest one currently running is only 75 megawatts, and that's in Llanwern in Wales. And the biggest one under construction is 600 megawatts, which not that much bigger than this one. Cleve Hill up near Faversham is 300, which is currently being built, is 375 megawatts, and that was the biggest in the country when it was proposed. But obviously, that's been pretty considerably dwarfed now.
What about the local people? What do they think about it?
So, a formal application hasn't been put in yet, so it's early days, but a solar farm boss in Canterbury told me that basically it makes perfect sense that it's a site where you'd want to put an installation of that size. It's, you know, large and flat, and especially because it's quite near Dungeness Power Station, which has grid connections, and that kind of infrastructure is one of the most expensive parts of solar and renewable energy projects. One local councillor told me he's open-minded on it. He's personally a nuclear enthusiast himself, so I think he would prefer to see reactors return to Dungeness instead. But he also wants to know what effect it will have on the local economy, because pretty much all of that land as it stands right now is agricultural.
Or what's the process for getting it approved?
So like I said, formal plans haven't been submitted, and since it's so big, the local council isn't going to be allowed to get their mitts anywhere near it. All the permission is dealt with by the government because it's a nationally significant infrastructure project. Now, that type of permission can take years and years, but new Energy Secretary Ed Miliband has approved a couple major solar projects shortly after taking office in the summer. So there's a good chance government might make a point of doing this very quickly. But as it stands, plans for South Kent Solar Park are meant to be submitted in 2026. And if all goes to plan, they say construction could start in 2029. But then they're at the mercy of the government planning system.
Okay.
So Simon, what's happening at Kent County Council?
Well, you kind of know you're heading towards an election when the leadership, the Conservatives, in this case at Kent County Council, start to reveal their attack lines, or what I think they'd be their attack lines. And they'll be directed at the government, particularly after the budget and the rise in employers' national insurance contributions and the effect it will have on some social care providers, such as charities.
How will it affect the sector?
Well, it comes off the back of a rise to the minimum living wage requirement as well. And we're starting to hear of cases where companies and charities are simply not going to be able to afford to pay for both, as it bumps up the costs significantly for their running costs. So this claims KCC may force providers to close, and then that extra cost, which will fall onto KCC's shoulders, will cause shortfalls in their turn. And that's obviously bad for the taxpayer. Kent County Council is now urging the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rachel Reeves, to immediately review her recent budget announcements to ease the pressure on services and the council finances. The relevant member, Dan Watkins, said this week, it is already strained to breaking point by the lift in the national living wage and chronic funding gap in the rising of demand. It means the uptick in national insurance contributions makes for a devastating triple whammy that will hugely affect what support is available for those who need it in our communities.
So what's the politics of this?
Well, I mean, it depends who you speak to, but I mean, it's a Conservative-led council and they've been complaining very loudly for a very long time about the massive and growing gap between the funding it gets from central government, that includes the last Conservative government, and the cost of providing the services it has to by law. Now, this was a case under the Conservative government, but it seems now the new Labour administration has dealt a further blow. So, but at least the Tory administration can blame Labour for not sorting the issue out of social care either, and the elections, which are held next May, and the outcome is far from certain as far as the Tories are concerned, but we can assume that this is going to be one of the lines of attack.
Nikki, what's caught your eye at Westminster?
So farming has been top of the agenda of our MPs this week, and dozens of Kent farmers descended on Westminster in protest at the government's new death tax, which they claim will destroy rural family businesses built up over generations. Those farmers joined thousands more from across the country in this mass protest. They're all calling on Chancellor Rachel Reeves to scrap her planned 20% inheritance tax raid, which is on farmland and property worth more than £1 million. There was a huge march, and that was followed by a rally organised by the National Farmers Union in a bid to urge backbenchers to block the new tax when the vote comes up. More than 170 angry farmers and businesses have also written to Kent MPs over what they've described as anti-rural measures that came out in the budget. And so one of those who is backing the farmers is Weald of Kent MP Katie Lamb, and she met some of them at Westminster on Tuesday when the protest took place and has described the proposals as an existential threat for farming and has said that the changes have obviously been cooked up by someone who's never set foot on our family farms. Another Tory, Helen Whateley, agreed. She says that the Chancellor's tax will devastate farms across the country, and that includes more than 250 that are in her own constituency of Faversham and Mid-Kent. Then you've also got Sevenoaks MP Laura Schrott. She met with local farmers last week and then met up with them again this week at the protest. She says in uncertain times, we should be strengthening domestic food production, not undermining it. And she thinks this tax is going to drive many out of the industry altogether, leaving us dependent on imports. Maidstone MP Helen Grant has described the move as a cruel blow to farming families and to the industry generally, adding it would negatively affect workers and consumers across the country. Then you've got Sir Roger Gale. He's the Conservative representative for Herne Bay and Sandwich. He went on later in the day to attend a briefing by the farmers' charity, Rabi. And he learned how many farmers are already struggling, not only with their work, but also with their mental health and how they're coping as people. So there was a survey of 15,000 farming people, and that's revealed over a third of them are suffering from depression. Almost half have experienced anxiety. A fifth of them know someone who has attempted suicide in the past 5 years. And one in 10 16 to 24-year-olds say they're lonely. Obviously, farming can be a very lonely job when you're out in the fields on your own, and that's quite worrying. Also meeting farmers has been Canterbury MP Rosie Duffield, as we all know, is now independent, but she's listening to some of those views as well and trying to hear what's going on from her constituency. Labour MPs have, understandably, been fighting their corner. We've had Folkestone's Tony Vaughan saying the changes are about fairness. Then you've got Gravesham's Lauren Sullivan and Ashford's Sojan Joseph reiterating the party messaging. They've been pointing out that the proposals won't affect most farmers anyway. Estates worth up to £3 million could still be passed on by a couple completely free of inheritance tax. And where that tax does apply, farmers are only going to pay 50% less than anyone else. They've said the policy is about protecting the smaller family farms and that the farming industry is actually going to see a £5 billion worth of investment over the next 2 years. And that's going to be the largest amount ever directed towards sustainable food production in our country's history. The government says this new tax will affect the wealthiest 500 estates each year, but the NFU and the Country Land and Business Association have got a different figure. They reckon it's going to be 70,000 farms worth more than £1 million that are going to be affected.
In more urban news, I hear there's also been some announcements about new money for Kent buses.
Yeah, and the government has announced £1 billion of funding across our buses nationally, but £23 million of that is going to be heading for Kent. So Kent County Council has also been given the power to bring buses back into public ownership. And that's been welcome news to many of the MPs. And East Thanet MP Polly Billington said she would always be banging the drum for better bus services, so she was delighted with the news.
Is there a topic that you would like to be discussed on the Kent Politics Podcast? Perhaps you've got a question for one of our panel, or you'd like to comment on a hot topic in local or national government. Get in touch by emailing or sending a voice note to Kent Politics Podcast at thekmgroup.co.uk.
Almost every corner of Kent got new MPs in July, not least the far east of the county. The Isle of Thanet was rearranged for this election and one half of it was conquered by the Labour Party. I'm joined now by the new MP for East Thanet, Polly Billington. Thank you very much for coming on.
Nice to be on here, Dan.
Firstly, would you mind just telling me a bit about yourself, your background, how you came into politics and how you ended up being the MP for East Thanet in particular?
I've been around doing politics on and off in lots of different ways for a long time, but I started my career as a journalist. I was a journalist for 15 years, actually at the BBC, and I really enjoyed that. But after a while, what I realised was that I was reporting on injustice, but I wasn't doing anything about it, or I didn't feel I was doing enough about it, and I wanted to be able to do more. So I was looking around to be able to work out how I might be able to do that. And I was lucky enough to secure a job with Ed Miliband when he was made a cabinet minister in the last Labour government, and then went on to work for him when we established the Department for Energy and Climate Change. So I've been working on climate change issues for a very long time. Obviously, since then, lots of things have happened and I've worked on a number of things, including being a councillor where I lived in London, as well as working for Citizens Advice and fighting a previous general election in 2015. But what I really liked about Thanet, when I'll be honest, I'm one of those unashamed down from Londons who has discovered Thanet and was just like amazed by what a beautiful and amazing place it was. I'm not the only person who has made that choice to move to a place which is quite so extraordinary. And I think what I really love about it is the fact that people do really value it as a community, whether they were born here or they've been drawn here. And when I saw that there was an opportunity to be able to stand up and represent that community, I thought I would see if the Labour Party would be happy to have me as their candidate. And they were. And then I became the candidate. And then I fought the election and I won.
Obviously, we're now a few months out from the pretty historic general election. Many people say it's been a bit of a rough start for the government. Just this week, there's been farmers' protests in London, scandals around donations and freebies and that kind of thing. I mean, what's your verdict on the performance of the government so far? I guess it's not ideal by any standard.
Well, I think what we have to realise is what isn't ideal is the inheritance that we've got. And I know people are fed up of us talking about it, but you know what? Before the election, everybody was very clear that they knew that we were going to be inheriting something really grim. The amount of conversations that I had on the doorstep when they were saying, well, it's all very well, but can you really fix it all? And that's why we were so careful about having some costed commitments that we knew we would be able to deliver in order to be able to start turning things around. And what has been really reassuring for me is being able to go through the lobbies, making those things happen. So allocating the money for more teachers, making sure that we're getting that money into hospitals, allocating money to local authorities so they can fix those potholes, a massive problem in East Thanet. And particularly this week and the week before, a couple of weeks before, is voting on transferring the powers for our bus services and money allocations to our local authorities so that we can improve our local bus services. That is really important. Now, I know people like to talk about big kit and fast trains and so forth, and we're very lucky in Thanet that we've got high-speed rail, which means that we're well connected to the capital. But it's the bus services that get you around a place and to and from the things that you really value, like the doctor's surgery, like hospitals, like schools. And I'm really pleased that we're doing things like that to be able to turn people's lives around in Thanet.
Before, during, and after the election, you would have been out pounding pavement, knocking on doors, speaking to constituents. What are the big issues that people in Thanet chew your ear off about when you go and knock to them? And what are your constituents telling you that they want to see?
Well, it's the cost of living is the biggest one, and the state of the NHS. Absolutely, without a doubt, both of those two things. And then thirdly, I would say a combination or a mixture of the immigration and the environment. Now, that doesn't surprise me. Those kind of top priorities are the same across the rest of the country. And when I talk to my colleagues here in Westminster, that's what you find. The cost of living has been terrible for people. And that's one of the reasons why we want to make sure that we get a bit of economic stability in the system. There's been far too much chaos for far too too long. And that's what people, again, were asking for. They were just saying, we just want it to stop. We just want to be able to afford to be able to have some time with our families at the weekend and not worry about the bills, not have to work three jobs in order to be able to make ends meet. And that's why we want to be able to get that economic stability in the country and get the country's economy growing again. So that's been a really big thing. And alongside that, and it's actually an economic problem, is the challenges that we've got around the NHS. Now, the NHS is a national health service and it's in crisis. Also in East Kent, it's got particular challenges. I was really struck by a recent survey that showed that less than half, about 46% of the staff in East Kent Health Trust would be content for their own loved ones to be looked after in those hospitals. That's a terrible indictment. The staff themselves who work so hard don't feel that their own loved ones would be safe. So we know we've got some particular local challenges. And that's one of the things that I'm speaking up for in the House of Commons. And when I talk to my colleagues who are in government, is this isn't just about, oh, Thanet is special or East Kent is special. There are a lot of coastal communities that are experiencing this. Poor public services. And that means that people are stuck on waiting lists, not able to work. So when we talk about the economy, this is an economic problem, and it's a particularly an economic problem in coastal communities like mine. So I'm standing up for coastal communities, particularly the issue of public services and the cost of living, and making common cause with other MPs that represent similar communities across the country so that we can get the government to design the reform and the investment that they're talking about in ways that will really benefit our communities.
On the NHS, there's a quote, I think sometimes attributed to both Hal Wilson and Margaret Thatcher, or maybe both, that you could pump the entire GDP of Great Britain into the NHS and it would still appear to be perpetually on the verge of crisis. You know, NHS funding is seemingly ever expanding, and yet it's always in trouble. I mean, they'd expect a full blueprint, but I mean, what needs to be done about the NHS? And it's obvious that, you know, simply throwing more and more money at it doesn't seem to be the solution. It hasn't worked for quite some years now.
Well, I'm really pleased that we've got 22 billion quid in the budget in order to be able to start turning the NHS round. But Wes Streeting, who's the health secretary, has been very clear that that money has got some reform conditions on it. So today, for example, he's announced a review into the use of physician associates, which actually has been one of the things that have been concerning people, is they're getting a kind of a non-doctor dealing with them in a way to cut costs. Also, remember that Wes has launched one of the biggest consultations, public consultations, to work out what people think would make a better improvement of the NHS. And he's joked about the fact that somebody literally put on the open source consultation firing Wes Streeting out of a cannon. And he says, unfortunately, that one's been knocked off. But the reality,
I think there were some that were even less polite than that as well.
Some of them were even less polite than that. But everyone has got a story about having got a text to say that their appointment's been cancelled, and then 2 days later, the letter coming to say that it's been confirmed. That when they then phone up, the people at the reception, who I feel really sorry for, are saying, oh, yeah, sorry, ignore that letter, take notice of the text, or the other way around. And that kind of chaos is costing the NHS because of those systems not working properly. And we've got to make sure that they work better. We also need to be making sure that we're using technology in the best possible way in order to be able to save money. And that's not just about having more people having online consultations, because actually I know that I can have an online consultation. It's much easier for me. I can pop it in between meetings. But I know that people who've got long-term health conditions who actually need to have a conversation face-to-face with their doctor, the GPs need to be freed up to talk to them so that I'm not taking up space. And recognising that access to GPs needs to be different for different people, and that we prioritise the people who really need that access face-to-face. I know that's a real bugbear of people in Thanet, and I want to make sure that they've got the GPs they can rely on with the services that they need as close as possible to them with easy access. So including, let me say, and I'll go back to it, making sure that it's near decent bus services. Because if there's one thing that really bugs people, it's them not being able to get to the health services when they're provided. Orthopaedics services, for example, are in Canterbury. There's no direct buses from Ramsgate or Broadstairs to Canterbury in order to be able to, for people to be able to get there. Now, that's the kind of thing that Kent County Council really needs to be doing something about now they've got the powers and the money to do so.
One of the other issues, it's topical everywhere, but particularly in Kent, you mentioned is immigration, you know. So Thanet District Council was briefly run by UKIP at one point in the 2010s in your constituency. Reform came third, eating a large chunk of the Tory vote. And just down the coast in Dover, they came second, you know, sort of chewing on your colleague Mike Tapp's heels. What do you think the Labour government needs to do on immigration? Because it's obviously an issue which is animated public feeling for quite a while, especially in East Kent, and I think that's pretty evident in electoral behaviour. You know, do you think it's as clear as the new government needs to drastically reduce both legal and illegal migration?
Well, I think we need to make sure that we answer two questions. Do we need the people who are coming, or do the people who are coming need us because they're fleeing desperate situations? And when I say do we need them coming, do we need them for our workforce? And I think those two simple questions, therefore from them flow more complicated ones about how we judge who should be here and who shouldn't. And I think what we've got is an enormous amount of illegal immigration through the boats and so forth, which is an appalling organised criminal activity which we need to crack down on, which is exploiting people's vulnerabilities, partly because we do not have legal safe routes and we are not identifying clearly who we need in our workforce and who we don't. Now, I know I would much prefer to be training up people here in this country to fill the vacancies in our workforce so that people in East Thanet have the opportunities that they want in order to be able to work in the public sector, start their own business, get skilled in the jobs that we need in this country. Well, we will also sometimes need people from abroad, and we need to be able to make judgments about who those people are so that we're getting the right people in. And at the moment, we've had for a very long time absolute chaos with immigration basically being in the hands of criminal gangs. So that's why we've got to crack down on the criminal gangs. That's why we've got to make sure that we work with our closest neighbours. That's why we've got to be able to make sure that we stop the drivers or contribute to reducing the drivers of immigration, which is big conflicts in other parts of the world. That's part of our heritage and our legacy and our role in the world as a big player. We're still a permanent member of the UN Security Council. That's left over from a long time ago. And we have a big responsibility to make sure that we use that properly to be able to tackle some of those drivers. But cracking down on the criminal gangs, making sure that we speed up the process when people are here. Far too many people lounging about in hotels, where actually those hotels should be used for our economy rather than housing asylum seekers, because they're not being processed. Now, I know for a fact, people have already told me that where we have asylum seekers in hotels in East Thanet, they're already seeing a speeding up in the processing of their claims. Now, some of them may end up staying, but some of them may also end up going home because they should not be here. And that is what we need to be able to do.
So obviously you talk a lot about smashing the criminal gangs and that kind of thing. That's something that Mike Tapp in Dover has been big on. And I've seen very few people, regardless of their opinion on immigration, would defend the fact that there's such an industry around extremely dangerous illegal smuggling of people into the country. But I mean, you know, surely the larger issue, especially numerically, does remain legal migration. You know, legal migration to Britain in the past few years has been something like 750,000. I think there's some argument that it's like 4% of Britain's population have come here in the past 4 or 5 years. And the budget predictions, the growth predictions in Rachel Reeves' most recent budget are still predicated on, you know, net migration in the hundreds of thousands per year into the country. I mean, you know, obviously reducing asylum claims and processing people faster is one thing, but do you not accept that at some point the government has to make a clear political choice that there is X amount of people that the country and its and voters are happy to accept, and every government elected in this country since the 1990s has explicitly promised to reduce migration, and under every single one of those governments, migration has increased?
Well, one of the things this government has introduced is Skills England in order for us to be able to skill up the people who live in this country. And like I say, I will be prioritising the people in the East Thanet in order to be able to meet the vacancies that we've got in our economy. And as our economy grows, I suspect there will be more vacancies. So we will need more of those people to be working. And quite often we have had a skills gap, which has ended up driving that legal migration. So we need to be making sure that we've got the people to do the jobs here. Now, I know that, for example, you know, I've been campaigning on the energy and climate change agenda for a very long time. And I know that it's brilliant that we've got two wind farms off East Thanet, which generate enough power to power 250,000 homes. But the reality is when those wind farms were built, those workers, very few of them, were from East Thanet. And I know when I've been talking to the mayor of Liverpool, where they've got a huge wind farm off there, he said almost the only jobs that people from Merseyside got were in the hotels, which hosted the engineers who came from Denmark in order to be able to install them. We need to close that skills gap. It's fine, obviously, running hotels. We know we're really good at it in East Thanet, and it's a fantastic place for people to be able to come and visit. But I'd much rather if we were training up engineers ourselves to be installing our wind farms and indeed creating the wind turbines themselves in this country. And that's what Skills England and our overall economic strategy is about.
So on a semi-related issue of the budget in general, obviously, local, you know, no secret to anyone, local government finances are in a bit of a mess at the moment. It's what, you know, it's why Kent County Council is cutting non-compulsory services to the bone. The new budget announced, you know, I think just over £1 billion for the local government sector. But a lot of people in local councils say it's still not enough. You know, there's the offer of multi-year funding settlements, which means they might have to go and rattle a can to the Chancellor every couple of years rather than annually. Do you think, you know, what does new government need to do for, you know, to sort out local government? Because a lot of the things that people see and don't like about day-to-day life, you know, boarded up shops, messy streets, that kind of thing, that's because local government doesn't have enough, you know, funding and resources.
Well, I think I can refer you to the last 14 years. Let's be honest about it. We have had a situation where there has been significant reduction in the amount of resources that have been available for Kent. Kent has spent £1 billion less over the last 14 years than it would have done otherwise. £24 billion of cuts in local government since 2010. That is a significant, and they spent 42% less on services. So when we see the mess, that is a direct result of the decisions being made at national government over the last 14 years. I totally understand that Kent has had a very, very difficult situation. And therefore, we need to, those multi-year settlements will make a big difference. And allocating £1.2 billion of grant funding in this year is a good start, including £600 million of it being specifically for social care. We know we have a social care crisis in this country. On top of that, you've got £1 billion for special educational needs and disabilities education. And we all know, every single one of us as newly elected MPs, how much that came up on the doorstep, how much this is not just an issue for a small number of families, but it is desperate for a much larger number of families than it ever has been before, because that system has been broken. So committing to £1 billion and alternative provision funding is definitely a step towards government's ambition to reform that system. And of course, and I just came in this morning into Westminster via the Tube and met the Veterans Association collecting for dealing with homeless veterans and supporting homeless veterans. But the government has also provided £233 million in this year to prevent homelessness. Rough sleeping is a moral outrage. We have far too much of it across the country. We see it in Kent, people literally living in tents in shelters on our coast. We need to tackle that. We can only do that if we are able to allocate money and reform the system, which helps those people get back on their feet.
On a unrelated but nonetheless topical issue, something that's been news a lot, and I imagine will be as it approaches the actual vote, is the topic of assisted dying. Obviously, it's a free vote. There's no, you know, party line on it, so to speak. What's your take on the proposals for legalised euthanasia in Britain? And do you know which way you'll be voting yet?
Just to be a bit pedantic about it, but it does actually matter. What's on the bill is not actually euthanasia. It's assisted suicide. The way that the law has been drafted, the legislation has been drafted, the person needs to be able to administer this themselves. And I think that's an important distinction from other proposals that have been brought forward at other times. I am minded to vote against, and that's not an easy decision, let me tell you. I'm not in principle opposed to the idea of giving people choice and autonomy at the end of their lives. I know the difference a peaceful death can have not only for the person, but for their loved ones when you're able to feel some kind of control through decent palliative care and the hospice movement. But the reality is, while we're in a situation where our palliative care provision is not good enough, our hospice provision is also not good enough, I feel very reluctant to enable this legislation, to vote for this legislation, when we won't be able to keep people alive, and therefore that we might be in a position where we're facilitating death rather than facilitating life. As I say, I'm not in principle opposed to the idea. I want to make sure that we get this legislation right. I'm not convinced that this legislation, as it currently is drafted, we'll make sure that we've got the protections that we need, or indeed that we are ensuring that everybody has the choices that they want at the end of their lives.
That's an argument I'm hearing a lot more than I would have expected.
I've got one final question for you on something quite broad. So in the election in July, when you and hundreds of other Labour MPs were elected, only one half of adults in the country actually voted, and only 60% of registered voters cast a ballot. That's the lowest percentage of the adult population to vote since universal suffrage was introduced, and means that, you know, only about one in five people actively voted for the Labour government. Does that worry you, and do you think it should worry politicians? Your government has an extremely strong majority, but by any standard, a very, very weak popular mandate.
Look, we've got the system we've got, and you've got to work within the system you've got. And you would understand why I might say a win is a win. I've also been looking at the issues of public engagement in politics for a very long time. I was a journalist, as I said, for a long time. And one job I had was being the political reporter, the first ever political reporter for Radio 1, at a time when people were really worried about young people not being involved or interested in politics. And I actually think the responsibility lies with the politicians rather than... There was quite a lot of people going, oh, why don't people care? And it's like, well, unless you're speaking to people and their needs and ambitions and aspirations, then that's on you rather than on them. The reality is, if you do not take part, then the decisions will be made by somebody else. I learned very early on, and it was one of the reasons probably why I'm here, is the decisions are made by the people who turn up. So if you're not happy with the decisions that are being made, then it's a reason to get involved. And that may well indeed change the nature of the politics that is being conducted in this country. I certainly hope that the politics in this country is better for the fact that people like me, who don't have a political background, are, you know, in terms of my family or anything like that, is able to start thinking about how we solve things for ordinary people. And that hopefully over time will mean that we will get a better country. And that's ultimately the reason why I'm here.
Polly Billington, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Nicky, you raised the issue of the farmers' protest in London earlier this week. But how this will play politically in Kent, particularly in constituencies which turned red but have a sizable rural population. What do you think, Dan?
Kent, like a lot of other places, I guess it's a feature of sort of British geography. You tend to have large towns surrounded by villages, and villages tend to grow around farms. So if you just go up at the number of parish councils in Kent, there's hundreds upon hundreds and hundreds of them, and every single one of them probably has a farm near it. Some constituencies are more rural than others. So for example, up in Medway, there's not that much rural land because it's a conurbation, whereas places like Dover or whatever, almost all the constituencies in Kent tend to be one or two large towns and then like vast numbers of villages around the outside of them. And all of those will have a very large sort of farming and agricultural industry around them. So obviously Labour MPs, newly elected to seats they've not held before, might be a bit paranoid about the mobilisation of the rural vote. But I would imagine that in most Kent seats, even if you had every village dweller in the land mobilising to vote against you, you probably wouldn't be able to unseat your MP on this basis, the only exception probably being Katie Lamb's seat, Weald of Kent, she'll see return. Katie Lamb, who's a Tory, and surely one of the most rural constituencies in the country. There's not a single major town in the entire thing, sure, Cranbrook or Tenston. And I imagine that, I don't know the demographics, but I imagine it's got tens of thousands of farms.
If you look at, traditional Conservative seats, like Folkestone and Hythe, which has been pretty much Conservative since the last war, you could have a Labour MP with a fairly small majority, but with a huge amount of kind of rural hinterlands sort of on the outer edges away from the coast. You could say the same about Dover. You could say the same about Ashford. and possibly other parts of the county as well. So it's not a given that to really hack off the rural vote, particularly since they tended to lean towards the Conservative Party, was necessarily was a great idea politically.
I think it's quite an interesting thing. I've sort of been around and seen a few of my friends from across the country and stuff like that, and speaking to them about this, it's quite interesting. Some of them, they're quite divided on this issue.
But everybody's talking about it. That's the interesting part of it.
Yeah, and some of them are definitely of the view that, you know, farmers are not happy with this decision, and therefore, you know, we should be spiting the farmers. They grow food and they that's something we should try and help. Others focus more on the inheritance tax element of it. It's reading into sort of the James Dysons, the Jeremy Fowles people who have bought these farms as possibly because of the rules around inheritance tax, and it was a way to avoid it. But I think, as you say, people are talking about it. And I read recently that in the Economist, there's a saying apparently that don't pick a fight with a job that's in a children's book, because it's very easy to understand. And so the average person can understand where the green grievance comes from. So farmers being a key example, teachers, doctors, these sorts of things. And I think whether or not you agree with the decision, and there is a debate to be had about it, this is having the dreadful phrase cut through. People are aware of what's going on, and because of that, people will come down on either side. And if farmers can, or people who want to attack the government, can make the argument that this is not good for farmers. People like farmers. People like food to be grown in this country. So it might be a very, very difficult situation for the government.
I get the feeling that the government completely misread how much feeling there would be. You know, but there was 10,000 in London this week, and that's a lot of people to turn up on what was probably the worst day of the entire month. And they turned up in their many, many thousands. And it'll be interesting to see whether this just helps to galvanise the Conservative-leaning vote ahead of the next election, which is going to be the county elections across the country. And obviously, Kent, being a very, very rural constituency, a very rural county, will be one to watch.
I think as well, there are going to be many people who haven't watched... thought about farming in their lives before. I grew up on a housing estate. It was surrounded by fields. I never really thought about
what goes on.
You know, the wheat grew, it disappeared. Back when I was a kid, it was burnt off. That obviously doesn't happen these days. But didn't think too much about it. There wasn't the farm shops. I mean, you'd go and pick your own strawberries, and that was about it. Farming is a bit more involved in people's everyday life now, in that they understand a little bit more. And I think as well that the fact about, and I think we've discussed it before, this is about, people understand that it's about a parent wanting to leave something to their child in terms of the inheritance.
It's about tradition and cultural.
It is about tradition and culture. And farming has changed a great deal as well. I mean, I live very close to a farm now that 2 years ago was cows, sheep. They were then butchered and sold in the farm shop. There was a bit of baking. There was a little bit of greengrocery. That has now completely diversified. There is a cafe, and probably more people now go to the cafe than they do to the farm shop now. They're opening a pizzeria, and they're going to have a bar installed. So there's all sorts of diversifying having to go on in farming, and farmers are struggling. And this is kind of like one more thing that they just don't want to be contending with, and you can understand why.
Yeah, this has been going on for a while. Three, 4 decades, you know, whether it's taking in campsites or, you know, doing their on-site butchery, as you eat, or selling, you know, they produce their own compost, or they, you know, they sell off their own manure.
They're trying to find every way they can to find us some money.
Because the actual bread and butter, the arable, the livestock, well, it just doesn't make enough money to cover their bills.
No, but they want to do something that they love.
I think the government could probably avoid some of the sort of anticipated secondary consequences of the policy, because obviously what everyone argues is that it means people will flog off their family farms, and that land will just be bought up by developers or energy companies or whatever, and they'll turn it into renewable sites and concrete over it and turn it into homes or whatever. That's partially an artifact of the fact this kind of policy proposal was created because of financialised land banking, where, you know, of exactly the type that people have talked about buying land as, which technically agricultural was a tax dodge, driving up the value of land so that now people who own perfectly normal and modest farms, they technically own multi-million pound assets, which will push them into the inheritance tax band. So the government, if it had the political will to do so, could undertake, you know, quite large-scale changes to the agricultural industry, consolidate farms or something like that, to avoid, you know, any of the threat to food security, which many argue will happen. But all those things involve
spending money, and it's a policy you can't just dig out of an old copy of Fabian Review, as I saw somebody put it. So I doubt they'll do that.
Well, I guess if you're not prepared to put people's taxes up, whether that's insurance contributions up or any other sort of personal taxation, and you've got to start tinkering around the edges, looking for the money that you're looking to plug the financial gaps. So that's the consequence of that, I guess. Okay, folks, that's your lot for this week. Thanks to Nikki, Rob and Dan, and our special guest, the new Labour MP, Polly Billington. Don't forget to keep an eye on kentonline.com/politics for the latest news from across the county. And you can also sign up for our newly launched politics briefing newsletter by visiting kentonline.co.uk/newsletters/. And finally, don't miss KMTV's politics show every Friday at 5 p.m. See you next time.
Thanks for listening to the Kent Politics Podcast. Don't forget to check out stories throughout the week on the politics page of Kent Online. And you can watch the Kent Politics Show with Rob Bailey on KMTV every Friday at 5 p.m. or on demand at kmtv.co.uk.
This has been an I Am Listening original podcast. For more information, head over to our website, iam-listening.co.uk.